From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tony Blair risked a great deal of political capital to support George Bush and the war in Iraq. But now Prime Minister Blair finds himself under intense scrutiny over the intelligence that both men used to justify the war. Are Mr. Blair's troubles a sign of what could lie ahead for George W. Bush? If the people of Britain were misled, does that mean Americans were too? Coming up on Point, one war, two perspectives. We begin in London, where a House of Commons committee is preparing to release a report on its inquiry into how the British government used or misused intelligence material before the Iraq War. Michael White is the political editor of the Guardian newspaper. I asked him, why is Tony Blair running into trouble?
It stems from the two dossiers which were published, one in September while the UN was debating President Bush's call for a second resolution, and later in February as we were gearing up for the war, two dossiers published with intelligence status. And part of the trouble is that one of them was basically a cobbled-together job by officials in Downing Street with no intelligence standing. Some of it plagiarized, I think that's the word an American audience would use, from documents taken from magazines and in one case, I think, from the Internet. And the other one, a much more thorough job. And since the war ended, and since it ended quickly and decisively for the coalition forces, a lot of the people who opposed the war are anxious to say, look, we were drawn into this conflict on false premises, because where are the weapons of mass destruction? Now, that aspect of the debate, of course, is familiar to American audiences. Where are the WMD? But in Europe, I think it matters much more, because as your listeners will know, there was a great deal more opposition to this war in Europe, in Britain as well, even though Tony Blair persuaded his party to join him in the coalition.
Are people then accusing Mr. Blair, in effect, of having lied to the British people about what was happening in Iraq?
Well, you as a Brit, Robin, will know that we don't use the word lie in the House of Commons. We use a series of euphemisms, one of which is dupe. And the shadow foreign secretary, that's to say the Conservative foreign affairs spokesman, the ranking spokesman, Michael Ancrum, said in Parliament only a couple of hours ago, we're debating the Intelligence Committee's annual report today, he said that Mr. Blair had duped the Commons. There were a lot of protests because dupe seems to me a euphemism for lie, and Labour members protested, and he said, well, I don't know whether he misled him on purpose or by accident, and if it was by accident, it was because his communications chief, the Harry Fleischer of the regime, very well-known figure called Alistair Campbell, had misled him on the point, had duped him. So this argument goes on, and while it does a Commons committee, much like a congressional committee, we don't quite have the status of congressional committees yet, but we're working on it, is investigating and due to produce its own report on who said what to whom and who misled or duped who and where it all went. It's a pretty introspective argument, but the larger issue here is trustworthiness of the government, and the Blair government across a range of issues in recent months has been accused of being less than frank with voters. So it's pretty important, both in the context of Iraq, but also beyond Iraq.
Can you spell out for us, Mike, where the bulk of the criticism is coming from? Is it coming from the opposition Conservative Party, or is it coming from within Tony Blair's own Labour Party?
I think the driving force for this controversy has come from the anti-war ranks, which, as you rightly imply, includes a large number of Labour Party members. Two members of the Cabinet, if you remember, resigned over this war, one before the war, the former Foreign Secretary Robin Cook, and Claire Short, the International Development Secretary, that's USAID equivalent, resigned after the war. And they both say the intelligence was not persuasive enough or strong enough to justify this premeditated and unprovoked attack upon Iraq. That aspect of the debate, of course, is recognizable in the United States, except that we did not suffer 9/11 and the great trauma which was inflicted upon the American psyche. And I think Europeans who don't go to the United States miss that bit. That's the big difference between you and us. When those towers went down, it affected you. It affected us all, but you far more worse than us. So you've tended to give the administration the benefit of the doubt in the way which over here we haven't. And all these jokes about Mr. Bush's poodle resonate quite strongly. And in recent weeks, the Conservative opposition, which was very supportive of Mr. Blair and Mr. Bush, they're very admiring of Mr. Bush in the Conservative Party in Britain at the moment, the Conservative Party have begun to join the attack and say, look, we were misled, this war was fought on quite properly, but on the wrong premises, and we want to know who's in charge of the intelligence policy and whether or not intelligence is being used to formulate policy or the intelligence is being shaped to justify policy already made.
Does it strike you as odd that there seems to be far more of a debate about these issues in Britain than there is here in the US?
No, it doesn't strike me as odd, because I know the tone of public debate and of the media, particularly the media in the United States since 9/11. I've been there two or three times, and it's been very patriotic and very much in a sort of salute the stars and stripes mood, much less questioning. I know that partly because newspapers like mine get an enormous number of website hits in the US these days, because people who are not signed up to the project, so to speak, like to see what the foreigners are saying, and we speak a version of English. So that's one element. And as I say, the anti-war movement was much more articulate before the war happened. And in a way, it could be said, and is said by Tony Blair's supporters, they're trying, as it were, to reverse the result of the war retrospectively by saying it was an illegitimate war fought unjustifiably because we cannot find these weapons of mass destruction. And in a critical detail in the British dossier, one which has caused a lot of trouble in recent weeks, in September 2002, Tony Blair's intelligence assessment said Saddam Hussein could fire chemical and biological WMD within 45 minutes' notice. And that challenge, although not remarked upon much at the time, has been picked to bits in this country in recent weeks.
There's going to be a report, isn't there, by the committee that's been looking into that on Monday of next week. Now, is that report likely to create serious problems for Mr. Blair?
Well, the leaks we're getting out of it, and I'm happy to say that one thing we have in both our cultures is that committees leak, is that the allegation that Alastair Campbell, the communications chief, sexed up, that's the phrase used in one of the charges made against him, sexed up the September dossier, particularly by promoting and exaggerating this 45-minute claim, which apparently came from a single but highly placed Iraqi source, thought to be an Iraqi senior military official, in order to frighten the voters and frighten MPs into backing this policy. I think the Labour-dominated committee will say the evidence that Mr. Campbell did that isn't there. So his detractors may have to retreat on that one. But there will be a minority report, and this controversy won't go away. My own feeling is that, of course, it's exacerbated at the moment in your country because we're beginning to shape up to the 2004 presidential election. Certainly the primaries must be quite close. And in our country and your country, because the peace is going much less successfully than the war, and British and American soldiers are being killed, and there's no sign that order and stability, let alone democracy, are coming to Iraq. And that's driving the debate and the controversy at the moment.
Bottom line, could Mr. Blair fall over this?
No. I don't think Blair will lose the next election, but nonetheless, it's a change of the weather.
Michael White is political editor of The Guardian newspaper. He spoke to me earlier from London. For several months before US and British forces went to war in Iraq, both President Bush and Prime Minister Blair insisted that Saddam Hussein presented a clear and present danger to the United States and to Britain. Left to his own devices, they said, he was capable of launching a deadly biological or chemical weapons attack. And they backed up that assertion with what they said was convincing intelligence information on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. But now, with Saddam overthrown, those weapons of mass destruction are nowhere to be found. And the accuracy of those intelligence reports is coming under intense scrutiny, at least in the UK. Here, though, President Bush has managed to avoid being caught up in the controversy. But might Mr. Blair's troubles be contagious if the investigations in London establish that intelligence briefings were manipulated or exaggerated? Will there be more pressure on this side of the Atlantic for public hearings here? Do you think there should be such hearings, or do you trust the President and his administration to get these things right? If the world does not trust American intelligence assessments, what effect could that have on President Bush's new doctrine of preemptive war, which depends on accurate intelligence? How important is it to you to know what the government knew about the threat of weapons of mass destruction? Join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now here in the studio is Pippa Norris, Professor of Political Science at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Professor Norris, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here, Robin.
Also with us from Washington is Spencer Ackerman, Assistant Editor at the New Republic magazine, author of an article in the June 30th edition of the magazine entitled The Selling of the Iraq War, The First Casualty. Spencer Ackerman, welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much for having me.
And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Points news analyst Jack Beattie, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you with us again.
Good to be with you, Robin. Hello to our guests.
Now, let's start with you, Pippa Norris. Tony Blair faces problems. How serious do you believe those problems are?
I think they're twofold. On the one hand, it could be about his judgment. If he was presented by intelligence reports and he believed them and he honestly thought that there were weapons of mass destruction and there's no evidence as yet, then people are going to say, we trusted him so far, and he thought this was happening, and yet there is no evidence. On the other problem is going to be veracity. It could be that, and indeed, the intelligence reports were minimal in some of their threats, but he exaggerated them, he essentially duped the public. And again, that's been an Achilles heel for Tony Blair ever since he came to power, how far you can trust this man. And when you look, for example, at the latest YouGov poll, the government was asked how far are they honest and trustworthy in March. 35% said yes, today 25%. So there is some damage.
Spencer Ackerman, you've been looking very closely at the way in which intelligence material was used by the US administration. Do you see parallels between London and Washington here?
Well, what I think is developing in Washington is a situation in which the terms of the debate are shifted away from what the administration knew from the intelligence it received and how it represented the intelligence that it received from the CIA and various other members of the intelligence community into simply what did the CIA and the other members of the intelligence community, the DIA, the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and other organizations in the intelligence community, how they collected this intelligence and where they might have gone wrong, which in the way the debate is developing over here means that any responsibility for any weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological weapons, or nuclear programs, or ties to al-Qaeda that end up not materializing will have sort of an insular effect, damaging the intelligence community and its reputation far more than it will the Bush administration. So already as this is developing in Congress, and it's only just begun to develop, there's a concern among the people who believe that there should be more of an open and thoroughgoing investigation into these issues, that already the debate is moved away from perhaps where it should be.
You wrote in your article, President Bush has engaged in a pattern of deception concerning the most fundamental decisions a government must make. That's a very serious charge. Do you really have the evidence to back that up?
I think we do, and I think we did quite a thorough and I would hope fair job of documenting in our article the ways in which when administration officials spoke about the eminence and the breadth of the threat from chemical and biological weapons that were in full-blown production mode and ready to be deployed, and a nuclear program that had been reconstituted to the point where administration officials were saying that the smoking gun in this case could be a mushroom cloud, obviously drawing up the rather terrifying imagery of an imminent nuclear attack. Rather, the intelligence that the administration's various actors was receiving was rather far afield from those claims. There were disputes in the intelligence community over whether the chemical and biological weapons programs were still ongoing. There was rather, I should say, consensus among these different agencies that at least some point, obviously, Saddam Hussein had these weapons and most likely was hiding what he had from international inspectors. But when it came to things like the nuclear program, not only was there no consensus over whether that nuclear program was restarted, there was rather strong condemnations of the intelligence that would suggest perhaps that it did from the most expert members of the intelligence community. Furthermore, when it came to the ties that the administration claimed Saddam Hussein had with al-Qaeda, which would link any attack on Iraq to the rather popular war on terrorism here, similarly, members of the CIA in rather experienced positions came to the conclusion that no strong evidence, or rather very circumstantial evidence, existed, linking Saddam Hussein to al-Qaeda.
Okay, we'll explore some of those parallels in a second. We're talking tonight about the political fallout after the war in Iraq. In Britain, Tony Blair is in trouble, but could there soon be parallels here? Do you think there should be a public investigation in the intelligence that led to the war in Iraq? How important is it to you to find out what your government really knew about weapons of mass destruction? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the political row in Britain over how Tony Blair handled intelligence briefings before the war in Iraq. Could his troubles be a sign of things to come for George W. Bush? How important is it to you to find out what your government really knew about what was going on before the war? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Pippa Norris, Professor of Political Science at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, with Spencer Ackerman, Assistant Editor at The New Republic magazine. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point's news analyst Jack Beattie, Senior Editor at The Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, let me bring you in here. What do you make of the idea that there could be parallels between what Mr. Blair is going through now and what Mr. Bush might be going through in the future?
Well, there could be. I mean, already there's one parallel. Mr. Bill Blair is being investigated pretty much by his own party, and that's going to be true now in Washington. The election in November turned the Senate over to the Republicans, and they are now, as Spencer said, narrowing the purview of any investigation to sort of lay off any blame, it seems to me, onto the intelligence agency. And they're not, and the focus is not at all on what the administration did with the information. Rather, it seems to be, you know, well, were you accurate or not? And of course, you can get into an infinite regress there. Well, they might have been accurate here. And I expect there's going to be a whitewash of this. And all of this, of course, is going to raise grave questions about the basic tenet of democracy, which is accountability. You act for the people and then you answer. And Mr. Bush, if he doesn't answer, either through these investigations or at the election, if it's not part of the debate, that's going to say something very, very bad indeed about our democracy. It's going to say that there's a kind of corruption here of civic, intelligence, civic commitment that exceeds anything one would have thought possible.
But isn't the political reality here that Mr. Bush knows full well that he has a very comfortable majority of American voters who approve of his decision to go to war in Iraq, even though there are doubts about some of the things that were claimed before the war took place? Bottom line, it doesn't really matter that much.
Well, but you see, already things are shifting there. The occupation is going so badly, so fast, that inevitably people are going to be asking, well, wait a minute, how did we get into this? And what was the reason? And why are we still there? And those questions are inevitably going to come back to hurt Mr. Bush. Already, one poll finds by 49% to 46%, people say you can't trust the government about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. 40% say they don't trust Mr. Bush about it already. Now, that number, I think, if these exposés continue, if the intelligence agencies seeking to exculpate themselves continue the drip, drip, drip of leaks, and things continue, and the low-level guerrilla war continues in Iraq, I think that 40% distrust of Mr. Bush can only go in one direction.
Let me just turn back to Pippa Norris here. The conventional wisdom is that the U.S. has a more open political system than the U.K. In general, American voters are told more about what their leaders are doing than British voters are. Do you think on this occasion we're actually seeing the opposite?
I think that the particular difference is the parliamentary system, which means that when Blair makes a statement in front of Parliament, he is accountable to his party and to his members. Whereas in contrast, what we have, obviously, in America in the presidential system is a much less close connection between Bush's statements and how he can be held accountable for his actions. In the last analysis, if the American electorate feels that this is a sufficiently critical issue, come the September election, then they can hold him to account. But normally foreign policy is normally a very distant issue. It's not really what people are concerned about. They're concerned about jobs, the economy, the bread and butter issues in both countries.
Do you think Michael White had a point when he said that a crucial factor here is that the attacks of September the 11th, 2001, took place on this side of the Atlantic and not on the other side?
I think that's a major impact. In particular, in the United States, the mass media has treated the threat of terrorism in a very consensual way. Throughout, ever since 9/11, there has been a broad impression that somehow America is under tremendous international threat, that this is the worst threat it's ever occurred, and that the public has gone along with this. In Europe, not just in Britain, I think there's been a much more divided reaction, partly because those events didn't occur on their soil, but also because they've got a longer experience of terrorism. And people there have been much more sceptical that this is a worse threat than ever before. They've seen terrorism in the past, they'll see it in the future. And there's a broader debate going on.
Spencer Ackerman, I had the impression from your article in the New Republic magazine that some of the things that you believe occurred here are actually very similar to what the critics of the Blair government allege were happening there, to the effect that politicians were taking what the intelligence people were telling them and then twisting it, manipulating it, using it to their own ends, sometimes to the great concern of those within the intelligence community.
That's more or less the pattern that I believe emerged, as we saw throughout our reporting. We talked with a number of intelligence officials and analysts who were involved in both the assessments of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction capabilities and ties to al-Qaeda over the past few years, and especially over the past year. And the pattern that emerged was that analysts felt that the work they were producing was, when taken to senior members of this administration, consistently questioned in a way that indicated that they wanted a more, shall we say, immediate threat picture coming from Iraq. And the administration has responded that just because they pressed for different areas of analysis doesn't mean they were trying to tailor intelligence reports to already preconceived policy.
But this is where the problem lies, surely, because in the final analysis, the way in which intelligence is assessed can be very subjective, can be very personal. You can put two analysts in front of the same piece of raw intelligence and they can draw different conclusions from it. It doesn't necessarily mean that one's right and one's wrong.
I disagree with that question a little bit. I'm sorry, I disagree with that statement a little bit. When you have on, say, an issue of whether Iraq is reconstituting its nuclear weapons programs, there are certain elements of the intelligence community that are simply more expert than others. For instance, the Department of Energy contains America's topmost, foremost experts on the science and technology of enriching uranium. And when they were assessing evidence of, or potential evidence of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs, its nuclear program, these things like these dubious aluminum tubes and so forth and other procurements from overseas, these experts came to the conclusion that these sorts of procurements were simply not evidence of a reconstituted nuclear weapons program, whereas other intelligence analysts, less expert intelligence analysts at the CIA and at the Defense Intelligence Agency, did not accept that opinion in part. Some did, some didn't. And as the weeks wore on, as the debate wore on, pretty soon the consensus that emerged was simply what the CIA had been arguing, and what in particular, what top officials of the CIA who had been sitting in on these meetings were convinced was taking place with these procurements, namely that Iraq was trying to reconstitute its nuclear weapons program. So I don't think you can say that intelligence analysis on every issue is simply a matter of two subjective interpretations disagreeing, and simply a hundred flowers will bloom and no truth can be determined from
Okay, let's take a call now. Guy's on the line from Jamaica Plain in Massachusetts. Guy, go ahead.
Hi. Regarding the most central issue here, in my opinion, I'm extremely, extremely concerned with the fact that the government of the most powerful nation in the world could almost single-handedly force the entire world into deep division and war, and it doesn't seem as if we have nearly enough the sense of urgency from the citizens in this country, in the U.S., to say, what the hell is going on? Because this is too much to just accept as minor misinterpretations of intelligence reports. I mean, with all due respect, you cannot say on the one hand that within 45 minutes someone could start an attack and then have absolutely no clue and no evidence in the entire country when you are increasing the number of people who search for these weapons on a daily basis. So if we're trying to claim that we represent the best version of government in the world, and if we're trying to claim that we are, in fact, spreading democracy in the world, why not start by behaving like a real democracy and not try to label anybody who says, let's find out the truth? How could we be scared of that if we are indeed a democracy?
Jack, is there a problem for a democracy in how much to tell voters publicly about what their intelligence people have discovered?
Well, yeah, and historically that's been the case about espionage and weapons systems and so on. But I think this is much overrated as a problem, and in this case, really almost notional. There, you know, it wasn't as if they were holding back intelligence stuff from us. They were, in fact, almost piping it. And Spencer quotes in his article the diplomat who went to Niger and investigated the claim that the Iraqis were trying to buy uranium from Niger, and he said the document claiming this was a fraud. That went to every part of the government, including the vice president's office and the administration. The vice president, the president, kept on asserting it. And this man, this diplomat, unnamed here but quoted, said that was a, quote, flat-out lie. Now, that's not, you know, holding back intelligence. That's a whole other kind of, you know, act than simply, well, we've got this intelligence we can't tell you. It's making it up.
But you see, what I was thinking of was I heard Tony Blair say several times in the period leading up to the war, but if you saw what I see coming across my desk day after day, you would come to the same conclusion that I am coming to. That idea that he simply knew more than he could tell us.
Yeah, and it's strange how that people are still willing to give the president here the benefit of the doubt, or at least they were, on that question. And this after Vietnam, after Watergate, after Iran-Contra, after we have repeatedly found that presidents lie, deceive, don't level with the American people on issue after issue. Nevertheless, after September 11th, it was as if it was tabula rasa. We're all patriots. We're all in this together. We're led by this selfless leader who, unlike other leaders in history, has no motives of deception in him at all.
Shlomo's on the line from Newton in Massachusetts. Shlomo, go ahead.
Hi. I'm an Israeli scientist working at Harvard University now, and I want to raise the point that the State of Israel went through a huge effort of preparation towards biochemical warfare before the Iraq war. And, I mean, all the people got masks, and were supposed to create special rooms, and the masks were opened, and it was a huge, it was very, very, very expensive, and it wasn't a theater. What I want to say is that the Israeli intelligence was also that there is almost for sure a biological and chemical weapon, and that Saddam Hussein may use them. So it's not, it cannot be only a political maneuver of the British and the American government. It's also something that I think that most of the Western intelligence services thought of something very materialized.
Okay, thanks for that, Shlomo. Pippa Norris, people generally, I think, want to believe, don't they, that when their political leaders take a decision as important as whether or not to go to war, they are doing so on the basis of the best available information, taking advice from the best available advisers. Is that perhaps one reason why people are sometimes quite reluctant to entertain the idea that perhaps it wasn't quite like that?
I think that's probably right. In particular, you remember earlier, Tony Blair on Bosnia had come forward again with similar sorts of statements and said, trust me, on the foreign policy issue, I am a leader and I know the problems. And on that, I think the Labour Party was persuaded that he was quite right in the aftermath of the war. And so on this one as well, they wanted to trust him. On the other hand, we have to remember that the French intelligence, at the time of the UN debate, had raised some very real questions and said, we do not believe this. And of course, Hans Blix at the UN was also very sceptical about a lot of the evidence, saying we need to look a lot further, we need to examine a lot more of the evidence in the locality. Wait, he said. So it wasn't the whole of the intelligence community speaking with one voice.
Is there, though, an element of another question of British foreign policy which Tony Blair needed to bear in mind, and that was what he quite plainly thinks is in Britain's national interest, which is to remain close to the US.
Yes, and that seems very much as the motivation, and that in particular, Britain has always had this role between Europe and the United States, acting as a diplomat, acting as the link between the two. And on this one, even if, for example, Tony Blair hadn't been in power, if there'd been another prime minister, it's very likely that Britain would have taken a similar role because this is the foreign policy position. The problem was that once they had adopted that role, the divisions between Europe and the United States became so enormous, and Blair found himself in an impossible position trying to link both of them, which he couldn't do.
Do you think that the controversy which has ensued means that if some future crisis erupted and once again the US wanted to go in a particular direction which perhaps wasn't very popular with the rest of Europe, would it be more difficult then for a British Prime Minister to do what Tony Blair did this time?
I think that's right. And I think that now people have looked back at the actions, in particular at the continuing problems of nation building which are going on in Iraq. And people very much in many countries are saying the UN has to have a role here. The United States is good at war. It's not good at building peace or at nation building. And in that extent, people are saying that we can't do the same sort of action again. We have to have a change of policy. And in particular, that the United States needs to become much more multilateral in any sort of nation building.
David's on the line from Madison, Wisconsin. David, hi.
Good evening to you.
Good evening, hi. Go ahead.
As a quote-unquote right-wing chicken hawk, I'm going to let you all in on a little secret, but one that a liberal like Mr. Beattie is already well aware of. The election of Mr. Bush, and we can argue as to whether or not he was elected, but there was a doctrine change with regard to foreign policy, and this was part of it. Was there manipulation of the intelligence? Was there even lying? Of course there was. But it served its purpose, and that purpose is a wider global dominance of the U.S. I mean, we need to be out there, and this is a way of doing it. My concern with regard to all of this is that the Bush administration may attempt to bail Blair out. And unfortunately, Blair knew full well going into this, you know, what the potential outcome could have been for him. And as far as I'm concerned, to hang him out to dry if he can't, sink or float on this on his own.
David, does it bother you at all that it might come to the situation where the U.S. finds itself on its own in crises of this kind?
No, not at all. I think we're on our way now to being able to handle these situations because of the Iraq war, that now that there will be an increase in defense spending because of the need for these measures to be taken with regard to these policies. I mean, the ball's in motion, and no one's going to stop it. And you know, I'm not letting anything out to anybody on the radio because people either fall on one side or the other. There are individuals who are going to support this 100%. There are individuals who are going to oppose it. But right now, the president rides high. This doctrine is in place, and it will go. It will continue. And there's really not much you can do about it.
But if I understand you correctly, your bottom line is if there were lies, if there was manipulation, it was in a good cause, it served its purpose.
Yeah, call it Machiavellian if you want to, but this is how politics works.
Okay, David, thanks for that. We're going to take a break in a moment. What we're talking about tonight is intelligence, politics, war, how they relate between each other. The British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, is under intense pressure over how he handled intelligence material before the war in Iraq. Here in the US, so far at least, President Bush has managed to avoid the fray. How important is it to you to know what your government knew before it took the country to war? Were there lies? Was there deception? If there was, does it matter? You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about why Tony Blair is in hot water over pre-war intelligence reports, while George W. Bush, at least for now, is not. Should there be a public inquiry here into what the US administration was being told by the intelligence agencies and what it then told you? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking tonight with Pippa Norris, Professor of Political Science at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and Spencer Ackerman, Assistant Editor at The New Republic magazine. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News Analyst Jack Beattie, Senior Editor at The Atlantic Monthly magazine. Pat's on the line from Boston in Massachusetts. Pat, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
My question is about how much does this have to do with the politics of personality? I mean, Blair is perceived, and I think is, tremendously intelligent, articulate, glib even. Bush has always portrayed himself and has been portrayed as a bit of a bumpkin, not as quick on his feet, you know, a much more sort of stick it to you, right or wrong, I'm going there. Kind of guy. How much does that play into, I think, is that has something to do with why the British are more critical of Blair than the Americans have been of Bush?
Okay, Pippa Norris, what do you think?
I think there is part of that going on here. And in particular, the difference is that when Tony Blair came to power, he was very much New Labour. That's to say, he abandoned a lot of the old principles that the Labour Party used to stand for in the 70s, things like socialism, nationalisation and so on. As a result, ever since he came to power, people haven't quite known exactly where he's coming from. And although I do actually believe he is a man of principle in all sorts of ways, for example, he holds very, very strongly to a kind of Christian philosophy in a way that previous prime ministers haven't ever emphasised.
But which he has in common, perhaps, with George W. Bush.
Yes, absolutely. It's one of the links between them, one of the chemistries. And yet, I think the public hasn't known exactly where he's coming from and has therefore hadn't felt that he's as trustworthy as, for example, Claire Short, who's very much the old Labour mould and they know exactly what her ideas are.
And who resigned eventually after the war.
Absolutely, on principle of this particular issue.
Okay, Jack Beattie, you mentioned a moment or two ago Vietnam, Watergate, Iran, Contra. I didn't really give you an opportunity to spell out what you thought the parallels there were. Can you do that for us?
Well, let's just talk about one thing, the Tonkin Gulf incident that became the basis for the Tonkin Gulf resolution, that became the basis, the legal basis for the Vietnam War. Here's what happened. On the evening, the night of July 30, 1961, a U.S. destroyer, the Maddox, reported that it was under attack from North Vietnamese torpedo boats. It was in the Gulf of Tonkin. The torpedo boats fired at it. A single bullet hit the Maddox. 2 or 3 days later, it claimed a second attack against it and another destroyer. And the administration seized on this and said, North Vietnamese aggression against Americans, I need a resolution giving me the authority to go far beyond the advisor stage in Vietnam and to take offensive action to deal with this threat to American security. Well, what were the facts? Well, the one bullet did hit the Maddox, but the attack on August 2nd was first claimed by the captain of the Maddox, and then he said, no, it was flying fish or something. It wasn't a second attack, and planes in the air at the time didn't see any North Vietnamese torpedo boats at all. So when the administration went to Congress, here's what they did. They didn't tell them that the second attack was very dubious indeed, that there were no reports of it, and the one report was denied, and they didn't tell them above all that these attacks had come in the context of provocative U.S. and South Vietnamese raids upon the North Vietnamese coast, and that therefore they could be seen not as aggressive acts, but as self-defense on the part of the North Vietnamese. That they left out completely. So it was a deception a fundamental deception of the people and of the Congress that led to the Vietnam escalation.
And Jack, are you drawing a parallel between that deception and what may have gone on before this most recent war in Iraq?
Well, I think the deception here is on a bigger scale by far. I mean, there was at least one bullet strike. Our forces were, they were in international waters, however they were conducting espionage. So it seems to me the reach, at least, of deceptions here and the range of them are far, far graver. Obviously, we're not dealing with Vietnam, thank God. We are dealing, though, with what looks to be an agonizing occupation.
Let's take Mudafa's call, who's on the line from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Mudafa, hi.
Good evening.
Good evening.
How are you? I need to make a couple of points. I am from Iraq myself, and I fought the evil regime of Saddam Hussein, but I I disagree with the war. It wasn't about Saddam Hussein at all, and it wasn't about weapon of mass destruction. But anyway, there is a dangerous thing I am noticing in the United States right now, which is the public opinion. Public opinion should be based on facts and truth and conscious measure. When the other caller justifies politics, he's like justifying terrorists as well. So if the goals justify the means, it can happen either way. And the other thing is, if people are accounted, if people are the leader in democracy of the will of people, I'm sorry, if the leaders are leaders of the will of people, but yet they misled it, this is, I think they should be brought to the court of people. And unfortunately, I don't see American public opinion rise to that level of real democracy.
Okay, Mudafa, thanks for the call. Charles is on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Charles, hi.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would invite your listeners to go back and look at the record of this administration in regard to the war in Iraq, starting back soon after September 11th, 2001. I think if people give a fair reading to what this administration said all along, that they had pretty much made a decision to go to war against Iraq that long ago, and that the whole thing about intelligence and so forth about weapons of mass destruction is really secondary to a decision that was taken way back then.
But do you believe the intelligence was there? Do you believe that there was intelligence information?
Well, I actually looked at this very carefully throughout the debate that went on in late 2002, and personally, I was impressed that perhaps, you know, I thought it was probable that Iraq had chemical weapons and maybe some biological agent and so forth. I actually didn't think that was much of a big deal since those weapons aren't really usable and had never been used against the United States. The crew question was whether it was developing nuclear weapons, and it appeared, you know, there wasn't the evidence. The administration never had the goods on that, and they didn't have it going into the war. And it turns out that, in fact, they didn't have that. So, you know, I think, you know, I would just really urge listeners to go back and listen to Secretary Rumsfeld. He was pretty damn consistent. He just said, you know, we've got partial evidence here. We don't need full evidence. We don't need to prove this. We don't need to really even know it. We just believe in what we believe, and we're going to do it.
Okay.
And he was very clear about that, and they went ahead and did it.
Okay, Charles, let's stop there, because I want to go back to Spencer Ackerman, who wrote this very detailed report in the New Republic magazine. Spencer, you wrote, what matters as far as American democracy is concerned is whether the administration gave Americans an honest and accurate account of what it knew. The evidence to date is that it did not. You say you have that evidence. Do you believe that Congress will at some point ask the administration to justify its claims against the evidence which you have put into the public domain?
I think ultimately Congress will hold a few hearings that will, at least one of them, will be an open hearing with some senior administration officials, but mostly it will, I believe, focus on, at least for the time being in the foreseeable future, what intelligence officials reported to the administration. I think that I've been working on this now for the past couple weeks. I've been talking to Democrats and Republicans involved in the investigations in the House and the Senate. And what it looks like is that the Democrats are trying to have far more of a thoroughgoing investigation, and they're in a position where they can't really do altogether too much, seeing as how the Republicans control the majorities in both the House and the Senate. So I think ultimately what will happen is that, at least as I want to put a caveat on that for the foreseeable future, unless more evidence starts to come to light that brings these allegations into starker relief that would be more resonant with the public, perhaps, I think ultimately it'll be a situation where a few hearings occur that happen behind closed doors. There'll be one or two that happens in the public purview, and outside of that, there won't be, I believe, a tremendous amount of accountability for this administration.
Okay, let me then go to Jack just briefly. Jack Beattie, your answer then to the question that we opened with. Do Tony Blair's troubles today give us an idea of what kind of troubles George W. Bush may face tomorrow? What do you think?
Yes, but in the presidential election, I think. I agree with Spencer that because of the nature of Republican control in the Congress, they're not going to allow this to get out of hand. Dick Cheney has already told them he doesn't want any investigation into this. So I expect, but if this is still a democracy, this has got to be an issue in the presidential election.
Jack Beattie, we'll wrap it up there. Thanks to you, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior advisor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. My thanks also to Pippa Norris, professor of political science at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and to Spencer Ackerman, assistant editor at the New Republic magazine. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a senator just back from Iraq assesses the reconstruction effort. This is On Point. A bipartisan contingent of senators returned from a tour of Iraq today, and they warned that U.S. forces will need to remain there for a long time in order to create a stable society. The senators urged the American public to be strong in their resolve, even in the face of daily reports of more casualties among American troops. 9 more U.S. soldiers were injured in 3 separate attacks in Iraq today. Michigan Senator Carl Levin is the ranking member of the Armed Services Committee. He voted against the resolution that authorized the war back in October. He gave a mixed review of how things are progressing in Iraq.
I'm glad the president yesterday said that we're going to be in Iraq for a significant period of time with significant forces. I believe that was long overdue. It's important that the American people be prepared for the long haul. Another thing that we must do, obviously, and Senator Warner referred to this, is turn over power to the Iraqi civilians as quickly as possible. We saw some real success in Kirkuk in that regard yesterday in terms of local government taking over much of the power, and it was quite reassuring. Indeed, it was quite inspiring what we saw in Kirkuk, both with the different factions and forces in Kirkuk coming together to participate in local government, but also with the people, the welcome of the people. To Americans and to us, although at a distance, we weren't able to mingle, but nonetheless at a distance, very strong, very positive, an outpouring, I'd say, of enthusiasm towards Americans in Kirkuk. That doesn't mean there's not problems. There are some problems still in that area as well. One of the things we must do a lot better is to get the positive message of what we're doing in Iraq across to the Iraqi people. We have done very poorly in this regard. We have our own TV up, but we do not have our message up. The message that we're not there to dominate, we are not there to occupy, we are there to help restore and reconstruct. And the Iraqi people in literally hundreds of places where we are reconstructing, we have projects going, development projects, probably over 1,000 places in Iraq, the Iraqi people must see Iraqis talking about those projects on Iraqi television, or our television, more accurately, that goes into their homes. There was a chart given to us yesterday when we visited with the 4th Infantry Division. This chart shows just in their area some of the projects that they are involved in reconstructing Iraq. And it is really an eye-opener, and it would be an eye-opener for the Iraqi people, because if the Iraqi people feel that in fact the people who are terrorists and violent are destroying their future, they are going to turn on the killers of their dream. New ambulances in Tikrit, I'm reading now from this thing, remodeling a school in Tikrit, facility repairs of the Ministry of Agriculture in Tikrit, bridge repairs in Tikrit, university repairs in Tikrit, health clinic supplies in Tikrit, youth soccer funding in Tikrit. It goes on and on. And this is one of the ways in which we're going to help rebuild Iraq and to rebuild the confidence, I believe, of the world community that the destruction and removal of Saddam Hussein was a very critical plus for the world.
Michigan Democratic Senator Carl Levin speaking earlier today, just after returning from a tour of Iraq. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.